loophole at the end of the spitpost, he was sat on a nest of sacking, meticulously polishing his weapon. A compulsive, Gaunt thought. The commissar stepped up to him. Larkin looked around, tense.
You always look like you're afraid of me, Gaunt said.
Oh, no, sir. Not you, sir.
I'd hate to think so. I count on men like you, Larkin. Men with particular skills.
I'm gratified, commissar.
Larkin's weapon was sparkling, yet still the man worked the cloth to it.
Carry on, said Gaunt.
But for how much longer? He wondered.
Part 5. The Angel of Bucephalon.
Larkin thought about death. He thought he might well have begged for it long ago, had he not been so scared of it. He had never figured out, though he had spent whole nights wondering it, whether he was more afraid of death itself or the fear of death. Worse, there had been so many times when he had expected to find out. So many moments caught in death's frosty gaze, snapped at by death's steel incisors. The question had been nearly answered so many times. Now perhaps he would find out. Here, death, or the fear of death. If the angel knew, she was saying nothing. Her stern face was turned down, demure, eyes closed as if sleeping, praying hands clasped at her breast. Outside, below them, the war to take Bucephalon raged. The stained glass in the huge lancet window, what remained of it, shook and twinkled with reflections of tracer sprays, salvos of blazing rockets, bright airbursts. Larkin sat back against the cold stone pillar and rubbed a dirty hand around his lean jaw. His breathing was slowing now at last, his pulse dropping. The anxiety attack that had seen him wailing and gasping 5 minutes ago was passing like a cyclone. Or maybe he was just in the eye of that storm. The ground shook. He felt it through the pillar. His pulse leapt for a moment. He forced himself to breathe deeply through his mouth, slow, deep inhalations of the sort he used to steady himself before taking a shot.
You are telling me how you came to be here.
Larkin looked round at the angel. Though her head was still angled down, now she was gazing at him, smiling grimly. Larkin licked his lips and gestured idly around with one dirt-caked hand.
War. Fighting. Fate.
I meant specifically, said the angel.
Orders. The will of the Emperor.
The angel seemed to shrug her robed shoulders slightly.
You are very defensive. You hide yourself and the truth behind words.
Larkin blinked. For a moment, sickle-shaped moons of bright white light and fuzzy oblongs of red blackness lurched across his vision. A tiny moment of nausea. He knew the signs. He'd known them since childhood. The visual disturbances, the nausea, the taste of tin in his mouth. Then the anxiety, the tunnel vision. After that, if he was lucky, a white-hot migraine pain that would burst inside his skull and leave him dazed and helpless for hours. If he was unlucky, fits, spasms, blackouts, and an awakening hours later, bruised and bloodied from the thrashing seizures, empty, miserable, destroyed inside.
What's the matter?
Asked the angel. Larkin tapped his forehead gently with his index finger.
I'm not right. Never have been. Not in all my life. The fits used to scare my mother, but not half as much as they did me. They come on me from time to time.
Times like now, under pressure, in the presence of danger.
That doesn't help, but it's just another trigger. You know what a ploin is?
No.
Round fruit, soft green-skinned, juicy, lots of black pips and pink flesh. They used to grow in my uncle's orchard on Tanith, divine things, but even the smell of them would trigger an attack.
Is there no medicine you can take?
I had tablets, but I forget to take them.
He took a little wooden pillbox from his jacket, opened the lid and showed her it was empty.
Or I forget when I run out.
What do they call you?
Asked the angel.
They call me Mad Larkin.
That is cruel.
But true. I'm not right in my mind. Mad.
Why do you think you are mad?
I'm talking to a statue of the Imperium, aren't I? She laughed and smoothed the folds of the white robes over her kneeling legs. There was a low and perfect radiance to her. Larkin blinked and saw glowing moons and oblongs in after-image again. Outside, a hail of gunfire lit the evening, and a ripple of explosions crackled the air. Larkin got to his feet and crossed to the nearest window. He looked out through interlocking pieces of coloured glass at the city below. Steepled, tall, rising within a curtain of walls 80 meters high, the capital city-state of Bucephalon clung to the ridge of the mountains. Smoke obscured the sky. Lasfire filled the air like bright sleet. 2 or more kilometers away, he saw the pair of enormous storming ramps that the sappers of the Imperial Guard had raised against the walls. Huge embankments of piled earth and concrete rubble, almost 1 kilometer long, rising high and broad enough to deliver armored vehicles to the top of the wall. Heavy fighting within blooms of flame lit the ramps. Below, nearer, the men on the ground looked like insect dots. Thousands churning in trenches, spilling out across the chewed and cratered mess of the battlefront to assault the forbidding walls. Larkin's vantage point was high and good. This shelled, ruined fortress was part of a stone complex which straddled and guarded the main aqueduct into the city, a huge structure that had defied the most earnest attempts of the enemy to fell with mines. Though heavily defended, it had seemed to Commissar Gaunt a good way in for a stealth team. Not the first time the Commissar had been wrong. Gaunt had told them that, before the clutch of chaos fell upon it, the city-state had been ruled by 32 noble families, the descendants of merchant dynasties that had established the settlement. Their brilliant banners, the heraldic displays of 32 royal houses, were displayed on the walls, tatters of rich cloth draped from massive timber awnings. Those mighty awnings were now additionally decorated with the crucified bodies of the leaders of those noble families. It had been Nokad's first act. Nokad, the blighted. Nokad, the smiling. The charismatic cult leader whose malign forces had risen to conquer Bucephalon from within and win one of the most honorable of the Sabbat worlds. In his great liberation address at the start of the Crusade, Warmaster Slado himself had listed proud Bucephalon as one of the worlds he was most eager to save. Shells burst outside the windows, and Larkin ducked back into cover. Glass pattered and tinkled onto the stone floor. The flashes behind his eyes were getting worse, and he could taste the tang of metal in his saliva. There was a moaning, too, a dull, aching groan in his inner ear. That was a particularly bad sign. He had only got that a time or two before, just prior to the very worst madnesses. His vision was not entirely stable. Everything in the chapel around him seemed elongated and stretched, like in the mirror tent at the Attica Carnival. In places, his vision belled and warped, objects shimmering in and out of focus, drifting near and then away again. He shuddered, deep in his bones. The angel was lighting tapers at the wrought iron offertory. Her movements were slow and lovely, pure grace. She asked,
"Why don't you believe in angels?"
"Oh, I do," Larkin sighed. "Not just now, before. A friend of mine, Cluggan, a sergeant, he was a bit of a military historian. He said that at the Battle of Sorolo, angels appeared over the lines just before dawn and inspired the Imperial forces to victory."
"Were they visions, do you think? Mass hallucinations brought on by fatigue and fear?"
"Who am I to say?" Larkin replied, as the angel finished her taper lighting and blew the long flame reed out. "I'm mad. Visions and phantoms appear to me on a daily basis, most of them conjured by the malfunctions of my mind. I'm not in a position to say what is real and what is not."
"Your opinion is no less valid than any other. Did they see angels at Sorolo?"
"Aye."
"Say what you think."
"I think so."
"And what were those angels?"
"Manifestations of the Emperor's will, come to vitalize his loyal forces."
"Is that what you think?"
That's what I'd like to think.
And the alternative?
Group madness. The meddling of psychers. Lies constructed by relieved men after the fact. What you said, mass hallucinations.
And if it was any or all of those things, does that make it any less important? Whatever they saw or thought they saw, it inspired them to victory at Cirolo. If an angel isn't really an angel, but has the inspirational effect of one, does that make it worthless?
Larkin shook his head and smiled. Why should I even listen to you? A hallucination, asking me about hallucinations.
She took his hands in hers. The feeling shocked him, and he started. But there was something infinitely calm and soothing in her touch. Warmth wriggled into his fingers, palms, forearms, heart. He sighed again, more deeply, and looked up into her shadowy face.
Am I real, Helene Larkin?
I'd say so. But then, I'm mad.
They laughed together, hands clasped, his dirty, ragged fingers wrapped in her smooth white palms. Face to face, they laughed, his wheezing rattle tying itself into her soft musical humours.
Why did you abandon your men?
She asked. He shivered and pulled his hands out of her grip, struggling away from her.
Don't say that.
Larkin, why did you do it?
Don't ask me. Don't.
Do you deny it?
He bumped against a pillar across the debris-littered aisle and turned back to her with ferocious eyes. His vision was pulsing now, lights and alterations dancing and flexing across his line of sight. She seemed far away, then huge and upon him. His guts churned biliously.
Deny? I never left them.
The angel stood and turned away from him. He could see the way her silver-gold tresses fell to waist length between the powerful furled wings which emerged from slits in her samite gown. Her head was bowed. She spoke again after a long pause.
Commissar Gaunt sent his fire team into the aqueduct on an insurgency mission to enter Bucephalon. The primary target was Nocad himself. Why was that?
Kill the head and the body dies. Gaunt said we'd never take this place in a year unless Nocad's charismatic leadership was broken. The whole city-state has become his doctrinopolis, the wellspring of his cult, to seed and spread the deceitful charm of his sensibilities to the other city-states on this world and beyond.
And what did you do?
We entered the aqueduct channels. Ron's company led the way to draw fire and break the defence. Corbex slid in behind to leapfrog the fighting as Ron met it and enter the city through the canal trenches.
Wouldn't you drown?
The canals had been dry for 6 months. They were mined and wired, but we had sweepers.
You were with Corbeck's company?
Yes. I didn't want to go. Feth, I hated the idea of taking a suicide run like that, but I'm Corbeck's sniper and his friend. He insisted.
Why?
Because I'm Corbeck's sniper and his friend.
Why?
I don't know.
Might it have been because you are the best shot in the entire regiment? That if anyone could get a shot at Nocad, it was you? Might Corbeck, your friend, have been reluctant to take you? Might he have been afraid you could snap if the going got too hard?
I don't know.
Think about it. Might he have decided to take you in the end because, no matter what the risk, and no matter how fragile your mind, you are still the best shot in the regiment. Might he have valued that in you? Might he have needed that asset, despite the risk?
Shut up!
Might you have let him down?
Larkin screamed and pressed his face into the stone floor. His wiry body began to twitch as the storm of madness, the tidal wave of anxiety, rose and crested in his thundering mind. He saw nothing but colours now. His vision was a neon kaleidoscope blur.
And what did you do? That firefight in the canal. Close quarters. Lopra dead, head blown off. Castin disemboweled. Heck, Grost, the others. The screaming, the misty smoke of burning blood. Corbeck bellowing for reinforcements, daggers of light cutting the air. And what did you do?
Nothing.
Not nothing. You ran. You ran away. You scrambled and ran and ran and ran and ended up here, sobbing, vomiting, soiling yourself.
No, Larkin breathed, spread face down on the cold floor. He felt he was in a vacuum now. There was no sound, no vision, no pain, just her voice.
You deserted them. That makes you a deserter.
Larkin looked up sharply. The angel stood by the reliquary, lifting the studded wooden lid. She took something out and placed it upon her head, smoothing her silver-gold hair under the brim. It was a cap, a commissar's regimental cap, Gaunt's cap. She reached into the holy box and lifted out something else, wrapped in dusty, mouldering cloth. Her perfect hands unwound it. A bolt pistol. With incongruous sureness, her slender hand slammed a sickle-pattern magazine into the slot, racked the slide, and thumbed off the safety. She turned. Her face, below the commissar's cap, was lean and angular. Larkin hadn't realized how chiseled and thin her cheeks and chin were before. Cut out of stone, firm and fierce, like Ibram Gaunt, she raised the bolt pistol in her right hand and pointed it at Larkin. Her wings opened and spread, 20 meters wide, a vast arch of perfect white eagle feathers.
Do you know what we do to deserters, Larkin?
She said grimly.
Yes.
We are created to inspire and uplift, to carry the spirit of battle forward,
to maintain the sense of glory in the hearts of the Imperial warrior. But if that spirit falters, we are also here to punish.
You sound like Gaunt.
Ibram Gaunt and I have much in common.
A common purpose, a common function, inspiration and punishment.
It seemed as if the world outside the chapel had fallen silent, as if the war had stopped.
Do you desert, Larkin?
He stared at her, at the gun, at the terrible wingspan. Slowly, he got to his knees and then his feet.
No.
Prove it.
Every joint in his body ached. Every nerve sang. His head was clear and yet racing and strange. He walked with measured care over to his fallen pack.
Prove it, Larkin. The Emperor needs you with him at this hour. Muster your strength.
He looked back at her. The gun and the gaze had not faltered.
How do you know my name?
You told me.
My forename, Chlain. I don't use that anymore. How did you know?
I know everything.
He laughed, loud and hard, his thin chest shaking as he stripped open his pack. Feth take you. I'm no deserter.
Tell me why.
See this? Larkin slid his sniper rifle from the sling across the back of his pack. He held it up and freed the firing mechanism with a deft twist of his hand.
A gun.
A lasgun. Workhorse of the guard. Solid, dependable, tough. You can knock it, drop it, club with it, submerge it, and it just keeps on going. The angel took a step forward, looking at the gun he held out to her.
It's not standard. Not a standard MG pattern. Where's the integral optics? The charge setting slide? That barrel, it's too long, too thin. And that flash suppressor?
Larkin grinned and reached into his pack. It's the sniper variant. Same body, but stripped down. I did some of the work myself. I took out the integral optics because I use this. He held up a bulky tube to show her for a moment, then slotted it into a bracket on the side of the gun case. He flipped covers off both ends of the tube, and the device spread a faint red glow ahead of the gun.
Night spotter. My own. I tooled the bracket to fit. I used to use it to spot for Laracel in the woods back home.
Laracel?
Small rodents with a fine pelt. Made a good income hunting them before the founding.
He slid his hands down the gun and tapped the barrel. XC-53/3, strength and barrel. Longer, thinner than the standard. Good for about 20 shots. He kicked the pack at his feet, which clinked. I always carried 2 or 3 spares. They twist and pull out. You can switch them in about a minute if you know what you're doing.
Why the strengthened barrel?
Increased range for a start. Tighter accuracy, and because I use these. Larkin pulled a power pack from his kit and slammed it into place. We call them hot shots. Overpowered energy clips. Liquid metal batteries juiced to the limit. Bigger hits, but fewer. Perfect for marksman work. And that's why there's no charge-setting slider on my piece. One size fits all.
The stock is made of wood.
Nalwood. Tanith-grown. I like what I know.
And that long flash suppressor.
I'm a sniper, Angel. I don't want to be seen.
Are you a sniper, Lane Larkin? I was sure you were a deserter.
The gloomy voice echoed around the chapel. Larkin turned away from her, expecting a bolt round in the back of the head. His own head was clear, clearer than it had been in months.
Think what you like. I'll tell you what I know.
He crossed to the arched doorway of the chapel and settled down in a crouch, the lasgun resting on a finial of stonework. It afforded him a wide view down onto the half-ruined canal on the upper level of the great aqueduct. Larkin settled himself, shook out his neck, flexed his arms. He took a sight through the eyepiece of his scope.
My company's primary mission was to take Nokad. He's a charismatic. He leads by personality, and that means he stays at the fore. This aqueduct has been recognized by both sides as the primary weakness of Bucephalon. We've attacked it hard. Nokad will want to defend it just as hard. And that means inspiring his troops along the length of it. And that, in turn, means he'll be here in person.
And if he's not?
Asked the angel. Then I'm just another nameless wooden marker in the cemetery. He was no longer looking at her, no longer caring about her terrible presence. She could be holding that bolt gun to his temple for all he cared.
You trust that scope to make the shot?
She whispered.
I calibrated it myself, and yes, I trust the scope. Funny thing, but whatever goes on around me, whatever madness...
And at that, Larkin dared a glance round at the hovering presence at his shoulder.
I always see the truth through my scope. It shows me the world as it really is. Truth, not what my fethed-up mind tells me is there.
A long pause.
Maybe I should look through the scope at you sometime, he ventured.
Haven't you got a job to do, Clayne?
Yes, my job.
He turned back to the scope and shut his eyes.
Your eyes are closed. What are you doing?
Shh. To take a shot, your breathing must be controlled. More than that, your weapon must be pointing naturally at the target.
He opened his eyes again and fiddled with the lasgun as it lay in the lip of stone.
What's the matter?
I need to baffle the barrel against the stone. I need cloth to wrap around it.
He began to pull at his cloak, trying to tear a strip off it. There was a shredding noise behind him. A perfect hand passed him a long strip of glowing white cloth, light and warm to the touch.
Use this, Thane.
Larkin smiled. He wrapped the silky material around the muzzle of his rifle and then nested it back into the stony overhang. It rested better now, bandaged with angelic satin, neatly snuggled into the turn of the hard buttress.
Thanks, he said, resuming his position.
What are you doing now?
Larkin flexed, as if fidgeting.
I must have a stable firing position. If the gun wobbles even slightly, the shots can go wild. I need a firm grip, but not too tight. I want it to point naturally at the target. If I have to apply pressure to keep it aimed, then it's going to miss. See, here's the trick.
He closed his eyes.
Take aim, and then close your eyes. Open them again. Chances are your aim will have wandered. Realign your body and repeat.
How many times?
As many as is necessary. Larkin closed his eyes again, opened them. Shuffled. Closed his eyes.
Eventually, when you open your eyes, the gun will be pointing precisely, naturally, exactly where your body falls and directs it.
You're breathing slowly,
said the angel, a whisper in his ear.
Why?
Larkin smiled, but ever so slightly, as to not disrupt the perfect pattern of his firing position. Once you're in position, breathe slow, a regular rhythm. Keep it going, nice and relaxed. When you get the shot, take a couple of deep breaths, pause, breathe out just a tad, and then hold. Then fire. Then breathe out fully.
How long will this take?
The angel asked behind him. As long as it takes to get a target. Nockad the Smiling sang to his brethren as they advanced down the upper canal of the aqueduct. An echelon of things that had been men, now trailing long, tattered robes sewn from the hides of those they had defeated. They brandished weapons, slapping them in dull time to the chant. They passed over the butchered and exploded remains of the foe who had assaulted their one weak link that afternoon. Nockad the Smiling was well over 2 meters tall, his frame heavy set and powerful. Piercings studded his naked torso and arms, loops, rings, chains and spikes armoring his sheened skin and glittering as brightly as his perfect teeth.
Make trophies of them,
Nockad grinned as he passed the corpses. Imperial Guard, weak, puny things, draped in dull fatigues and anonymous cloaks. There was fighting ahead, the barking returns of lasguns at close range. Korbeck was in the canal gully with 3 remaining men and Rawn yelling through the intercom.
It's no good. They've got it sealed tight. We have to withdraw.
Fath ye, Rawn. This is the only way. We move in. Bring your men forward.
At suicide, Korbeck. You fool! We'll all be dead in a moment!
Are you deserting me, Major? Is that what you're doing? There's a price for that.
Faith, you insane moron! You'd have to be utterly mad to go in there.
Nockad advanced. His men loved him. They sang together, jubilant as they forced the invaders back. On the canal lip, Nockad howled his inspirational verses to his men, arms uplifted, chainsword whirring. There was a crack, a stab of light, and Nockad's head vanished in a film of blood. Larkin fell back in the doorway, frothing and convulsing, spasms snapping his body as the brain fever took hold once more.
Larks? Larks? Korbeck's voice was soft.
Larkin lay in a fetal ball, messed by his own fluids, in the doorway of the shattered chapel. As he came around, he felt his mind was clear, violently clear, like it had been purged with light.
Calm.
You son of a bitch, Larks. Korbeck pulled him upright, unsteady on his legs. Larkin's lasgun lay on the floor, its barrel broken, burnt, and spent.
You got him? You got him, you old bastard. You smoked him good?
I did.
Listen to that,
Korbeck crowed, pulling Larkin around towards the doorway. There was a cheering and chanting noise rising from below the aqueduct.
They've surrendered! We've taken Bucephalon! Nockad is fried!
Shit! Larkin sank to his knees.
And I thought you'd run out on us! Honestly, I thought you'd feth and deserted!
Me? Larkin said, looking up.
I shouldn't have doubted you, should I?
Korbeck asked, bear-hugging the wiry little sniper.
Where's the angel gone?
Larkin said quietly.
Angel?
There's no angel here except her. Korbeck pointed to the damaged statue of the angel above the chapel font. A beautiful winged woman knelt in the attitude of prayer. Her perfect hands were clasped. Her head was bowed demurely. The inscription on the plinth rejoiced that she was a symbol of the God Emperor, a personification of the Golden Throne, who had come to the elders of Bucephalon in the first days of the colony and watched over them as they conquered the land. An old myth. A hunk of stone.
But,
Larkin started as Korbeck dragged him to his feet.
But nothing,
Korbeck laughed. Larkin began to laugh too. He convulsed and gagged with the force of laughter inside him. Korbeck dragged him from the chapel, both laughing still. The very last thing Larkin saw before Korbeck wrenched him away was his fallen lasgun, with the peerless, scorched white cloth still wrapped around the barrel.
A sudden barrage of enemy guns, distant, impatient, came on just before the middle of the night over Monthax, and stippled the belly of the low brown sky with reflected flashes of fire and light. Wet, hollow rumbles barked and growled through the swamps and ground mist like starving hounds. Leagues away, some brutal night combat was underway. Gaunt woke instinctively at the sound of the guns and took a walk out of the command shed. The sound was coming from the east, and he had a sergeant circle around to check on the sentry lines. The artillery sounded like someone flapping and cracking a large, sweat-damp sheet in the hot, heavy air. He crossed a gurgling creek via a duckboard bridge and made it into the tree line just as the humidity broke and cold, drooling rain began to fall through air, suddenly stirred by chill breezes. It was almost a relief, but the rain was sticky and sappy and stung his eyes. Gaunt found himself on the embanked approach to one of the main sentry towers and pulled himself up the ladder. The towers, set at 100-meter intervals along the main defile, rose some 10 meters out of the surface filth. They were fashioned from groups of tree trunks, shored together and stoutly buttressed with riveted beams, and supported large, flakboard gun nests mounted on the top. Up in the dark nest, Trooper Bragg tended a cradle-mounted pair of twinned heavy bolters, drums of shells piled around his huge feet. A flakboard cover kept the rain off, and the nest was shrouded by netting.
"Sir,"
Bragg saluted, his big face cracking into a broad, embarrassed grin. He was making fortified caffeine over a little burner, his huge paws dwarfing the pot and cup. He tried to hide the flask of sacra behind the stove, but the scent of the liquor was pungent in the close air of the nest. Gaunt nodded the salute. "I'll have one myself," he said. "A stiff one." Bragg seemed to relax. He sloshed a generous measure of sacra into a second battered cup and fussed over the boiling pot. Gaunt was amused, as always, by the combination of brutal strength and timidity in this giant of a man. Bragg's hands were big and strong enough to crush skulls, but he moved almost meekly, as if afraid of his own strength, or afraid of what others might think him capable of. He handed the commissar a hot cup, and Gaunt sat on a pile of shell drums, gesturing out across the jungle to the east. The nest's raised vantage point afforded a better view of the distant fighting. Flares and traces showed above the trees, and as the rain dissipated the mist, there were ruddy ground fires to be seen amid the trunks.
"Someone's having fun," he remarked.
Bragg nodded, sipping his own cup.
"I make 4 or maybe 5 enemy positions, infantry support teams. They've advanced and dug in because the fire patterns are static, but they've found something to shoot at.
If they move this way, we'll need to take action."
Bragg patted his heavy weapons.
"Let 'em come,"
Gaunt grinned. Bragg was a good heavy weapons technician, but his aim had scarcely improved since the founding. Still, with guns with that sort of cycle rate and that much ammo, he should hit something.
"Oh, well, I remember," Gaunt said. "The western embankments are collapsing again. I told Major Rawn that you'd help the detail redig tomorrow. They need some heavy lifting."
Bragg nodded without question. His great physical strength was an asset to the Ghosts, and was matched by his geniality and willingness to help. He reminded Gaunt of some great blunt weapon, like a club, deadly when delivered properly, but difficult to wield or aim. Bragg batted a moth away from his face.
"Precious little place we've found here," he remarked.
"Monthax is short on charm,"
Gaunt admitted, studying the hulking trooper quizzically. Bragg was a strange man. Gaunt had decided that long ago. He'd never met a human so physically powerful, yet mentally restrained, as if he was somehow afraid of the terrible power he could unleash. Others took it for stupidity and regarded big old Bragg as dumb. But the man patently wasn't stupid. In his own quiet, mountainous way, he was the most formidable and dangerous ghost of all. So preoccupied by his physical power, others always underestimated the mind behind it. And the mind, Gaunt knew, was the strongest thing of all.
Part 6. That Hideous Strength. Caligula, after the Imperial liberation. Nights as bright as day, lit by the burning hive cities. Days as dark as night, choked by the petrochemical smoke. Soot, like fat black snowflakes, fluttered down everywhere. Even out here, in the Deadlands. Steepled canyons of coral bright rock. wisps of fluorescent dust licking the high places and the rims of the calderas. Cracked, dry basins of hard, russet cake earth. Wide, slumping ridges of glass sand. And death, bleached and baked white, like bones that had been out in the sun for years. 18 cargo transports, 30-wheel monsters, coughing blue exhaust from their vertical pipe stacks, ground down the Red Rock Pass in low gear. The tractor units at the front of each payload wagon were monsters, armored cabs of scorched metal rattling on top of a huge engine unit, glaring forward through multiple fog lamp eyes and grinning fly-flecked smiles of fender bars, radiator grills, and spiked running boards. Flanking the massive transports were the outriders, rushing through the dust on track bikes and in armored cars. Palapé Touvent, transport driver, Caligula born and bred, wrestled with the half-moon wheel of the convoy's lead freighter and glanced around at his co-driver. Cluin Milum was looking out of the cab window, occasionally regarding his chronometer. They were both wringing with sweat, entombed by the heat from the roaring engine under their feet. Milum had dropped the window armor panels and opened the metal vents in the hope of washing them with cool breeze from outside. But the surface temperature out in the deadlands was pushing 40 degrees, and they baked. Occasionally, sprays of hot engine oil spurted back from the leaky head gasket and spattered in at them through the forward grill screen. Milum sat back in his ripped leather seat and looked up at the cab's ceiling hatch.
"He's still up there,"
Touvent nodded, wrenching the wheel. Both of them were all too used to the juddering, shaking motion of the vehicle.
"Probably sticking his head out of the turret like a dog, enjoying the rush of air."
Milum chuckled.
"Kick, but he's a dumbass, right? Never stood in line for brains."
Touvent nodded.
"Typical guard, all muscle and no head. Where the keck were they when the hives fell, huh? Answer me that."
"In a troopship and transit,"
Trooper Bragg answered plainly, his huge bulk clambering down the rungs from the top hatch to join them. He stood at the back of the cab, holding onto a roll bar for support as the tractor lurched over uneven ground.
"Colonel Commissar Gaunt said we got here as fast as we could."
He smiled sheepishly at the two-man driving team.
"I'm sure he did,"
Touvent murmured. Bragg edged forward, using handholds to stop himself from falling.
"We're making good time, aren't we?"
"Brilliant time," Milum replied, turning away from the big ghost. "Calpurnia Station will rejoice when we arrive."
"I'm sure it will,"
Bragg smiled, sinking into the bench seat behind the driver's position.
"That'll be good. When the Colonel Commissar ordered me to command this convoy detail, I said to him, I will get it through on time. Trust me, Colonel Commissar, I will." "And we are, aren't we?"
"Yes, we are. Right on time," Touvent said.
"Good. That's good. The Colonel Commissar will be pleased."
Malum muttered something unflattering about the high and mighty Colonel Commissar.
"What did you say?"
Bragg asked sharply. Malum stiffened. He looked across at Touvent. They'd been in the company of this huge guardsman for maybe 3 hours, all told, and had so far reckoned him to be dim-witted and slow. Of course, his sheer bulk was impressive, but they had felt confident about laughing at him behind his back. Now Milum tensed, feeling perhaps he'd gone too far, feeling the giant behind them might suddenly unleash his undoubted physical power in a mindless tantrum.
I didn't say anything."
"You did. You said something about my Colonel Commissar."
"Something bad."
Milum turned slowly to face the huge Tanith.
"I didn't mean anything. I was just joking."
"So it was a bad thing. An insult."
"Yes, but just a joke."
Milum tensed, expecting the worst, reaching his left hand down beside his seat for the axle bar he kept stowed there.
"That's okay,"
Bragg said lightly, turning to look out of a window.
"Everyone is entitled to their opinion. The Colonel Commissar told us that."
Milum sat back and exchanged knowing grins with the driver. A total dummy, they agreed, wordlessly.
"So?"
Touvent asked, teasing, looking at Bragg in the rearview mirror.
"You do everything this Colonel Commissar tells you?"
"Of course,"
the giant replied brightly.
"He's the Colonel and the Commissar. We're his men. We're Imperial Guard, Tanith first and only. We're loyal to the Emperor, and we do everything the Colonel Commissar tells us." "What if he told you to jump off a cliff?"
Milum laughed, conspiratorially sharing the baiting with Touvent.
"Then we'd jump off the cliff." Was that a trick question?
The convoy rolled on into the Deadlands. It had assembled that morning on a stained curtain road outside the half-burned ruin of the Aurelian Hive City, where a second front of Imperial Guard had seized control after the main assault on Nero Hive. The mammoth Imperium victory was in no doubt, but still pockets of enemy soldiers held out, fighting a lingering war of wastage and attrition to wear out the lines of supply. The Imperial Guard closed in en masse to root out and eradicate all remnants of resistance, and the work to rebuild Caligula began. What resources were available, and despite everything, Aurelian Hive was rich in storehouses, had to be redistributed. The convoy marked the first attempt to convey relief supplies to the stricken Hive Calpurnia. That meant a 200-kilometer crossing of the battle waste recently dubbed the Deadlands. Six convoys had departed Aurelian Hive that dawn. Four were headed to Nero Hive, one to Tiberias, and one to Calpurnia. Gaunt's ghosts, the Tanith First, were given the protection duty. It was agreed that the run to Calpurnia was the most dangerous, as it crossed the territories of bandits, ex-hive workers who had fled the war and set themselves up as feudal warlords in the waste. Not a single relief vehicle had made it through in the last 6 weeks, and the rumors told of thousands of rebels stockpiling weapons. Some even whispered that chaos powers were involved. Everyone, including Bragg himself, was amazed when Gaunt chose Bragg to command the defense of the Calpurnia convoy. Gaunt had ignored all the protests and taken the bemused Bragg into his command bunker to brief him. Keober, Rorn, Larkin, and the other ghosts decided that Gaunt's choice simply represented an acceptance that the Calpurnia convoy wouldn't get through. It was a write-off, and Gaunt wasn't going to waste any decent commander to such long odds.
"And so our caring commissar shows his true colors," Rorn had hissed, playing with the hilt of his silver Tanith dagger.
Others fidgeted nervously, unhappy with what seemed to be going on, but unwilling to question Gaunt's authority directly. Bragg simply grinned at the honor bestowed upon him. It seemed he missed the irony. He was oblivious to the fact that he was already given up as dead. Rorn spat in the dust. At the behest of the men, Korbeck had approached Gaunt fiercely, demanding to know why Gaunt had been so callous as to deem Bragg expendable.
"Sir, with me or Haska or Larod at the helm, we might get a chance to drive that convoy through. Don't throw it away. Don't waste Bragg."
"I know what I'm doing," Gaunt had replied curtly, sending the proud Bragg and 70 other ghosts off on the detail from which everyone was sure no one would come back.
The convoy rumbled down a wide-bottomed crevasse and began to cross a cracked red dust plain of baked earth. Heat shimmered up, distorting the horizon. Outrider One roared ahead of the convoy, a track bike driven by Corporal Merrin with Trooper Kafran manning the pintle-mounted twin autocannons in the rear. Both had their stealth cloaks wrapped up around their mouths against the heat and dust, and wore filmed, heat-crazed goggles. Merrin heaved the cycle to a halt on a rise, the convoy a kilometer behind them, and pulled down his swaddling dust veils to spit and cough.
"You feel that?" he called back to Kafran. "Eyes watching us from all around."
"Just your imagination," Kafran returned,
cranking the guns round all the same. Kafran felt a pulse in his temple that wasn't simply the heat. He'd seen the expression on Colonel Corbeck's face when Gaunt had given the convoy command to Bragg. They were dead out here, as good as written off. The 100 burnt and crucified bodies they had passed on the roadside an hour before had nothing to do with imagination. Kafran shuddered. Other outriders whirred forward in hazes of dust. Trooper Kelv drove one cycle with Mert, one of Corbeck's favored sharpshooters, in the rear cradle. Mert had his sniper gun wrapped in oilcloth in the footwell below him, ready to switch to it when the autocannon rig ran dry. Kelv pulled them up to a riving halt on a sand rise. To their left, engine idling, was Ochrin and his gunner Helat. To their right, 500 meters distant, McKendrick and his gunner Beris. A signal waved from bike to bike, then they all flew forward into the dusty basin beyond, racing parallel to the track left by Merrin and Kafran. The huge convoy thundered in after them. Tailing it and flanking the rear came three more outriders. Fulk with Logris gunning, McTee with Layman at the weapons, and Tanak with Grummid manning the cannons.
Behind them, an Imperial Guard half-track driven by Weln, with Abbott and Brostin at the weapons stations, and another with long double tracks driven by McTeague, with Rahan and Nain crewing a missile launcher platform. Bragg clambered up into the gun turret over the cab of his tractor, half hearing the whispered slanging of the Caligulan drivers, Milum and Tuvant. Heat and dust assaulted his big face. The sun was a torrential heat. His nostrils immediately clogged with ash dust, and he had to hawk and spit to clear his head. As an afterthought, he wrapped his stealth cloak around his mouth and nose, pulling out the goggles he had been issued, and also remembering to wipe zinc paste over his exposed skin. The paste, clagging and damp in a small circular tin, smelled bad, but the Colonel Commissar had told them all to use it. Bragg lifted his micro-bead comm set and slid the plug into his ear.
"Bragg, to all ghosts, remember to use your sun paint, the zinc stuff, like the Colonel Commissar told us. Over."
Over the Voxlink came a round of curses and protests.
"I mean it," Bragg said. "Wipe it on, Tanith. There's burning, and there's burning," the Colonel Commissar said, "and our fair skins won't last a minute out in this."
Sliding his bike to a halt, Ochrin pulled out his tin and grudgingly applied paste to his brow and nose. He held the tin out, straight-armed, to Hellat in the back. There was a soft, distant ping, a hollow, empty sound. Hellat took the tin from Ochrin's outstretched hand just as he realized Ochrin no longer had a face. Ochrin's corpse flopped stiffly back off the saddle. Hellat cried out in alarm, gripping the yokes of his pintle weapon and raining metal fury on the distant dunes.
"Ochrin's down! We are attacked!"
he screamed as he fired. A second later, a missile lifted his cycle into the air and blew Hellat and Ochrin's corpses into pieces of cooked meat, each no larger than a clenched fist. Box traffic suddenly tumbled in confusion over the static. Murmuring the litany of protection the Ecclesiarch had taught him back on Tanith at the Primer Educatory, McTeague drew his half-track hull down behind a salty dune, and his weapon crew spat a rack of missiles into the cliff edges. Merrin drove his cycle around in a wide arc, pulling to rejoin, puffing up a wide skim of dust. Caffran rattled round the gun mount and flickered off a curving row of tracer shells into the position marked by Hellat's last assault. Ochrin and Hellat's vehicle lay in a burning heap on a crisped sand rise. The main convoy slowed as the attack made itself known. The enemy fire wickered into them from the right-hand side like rain, a few shots at first, then faster and more furious. McKendrick raced his bouncing bike in, screaming a Tanith war cry, and only when his gunner didn't begin firing did he turn to find Beris hanging dead over the pintle mount, sunlight shining through a vast hole in his torso. McKendrick braked, leapt out of the driver's position, and tossed Beris's corpse aside, maniacally training and firing the guns from a stationary position. As his cycle raced into the firefight, Mert knew he had a good angle, pumping round after round from the big caliber guns into the distant dust dunes. He screamed to his driver to go faster and overrun the enemy. Kelv was about to reply, or was halfway through saying something, when a salvo of stub rounds tore the vehicle to pieces and overturned them. Mert pulled himself out of the dust and looked round to see Kelv trapped under the wreckage, shrieking in pain. The control column had impaled him, ripping him open and pinning him into the sand under 3 tons of twisted, smouldering metal. Mert ran to him, trying to raise the wreck, trying to tip it over. Kelv bayed at him, begging, pleading. When Mert realized how heavy the wreck was and how grievous Kelv's wound, he did as his driver instructed him. He took out his las pistol and shot Kelv through the head, point blank. Kelv's body spasmed and died, gratefully. Mert dived flat as further fire found his position. He located his swaddled sniper gun, thrown clear out from the wreck. There was no time to check for damage. He pulled off the cloth, lay low, and sighted, snuggling a fresh power cell into the receiver. His long sight brought the enemy into view, magnified, hazy, distant figures milling around trying to reload a khaki-painted missile launcher. He made his first shot. It went long. He adjusted his scope as Larkin had taught him, breathed out, and made the second shot a clean kill. The enemy were turning in confusion when he made his next 3 shots in calm, cold series. 3 clean hits. Sniper Master Larkin would be proud. Atop the main tractor, Bragg yelled into his microbead, ordering the convoy to form a defensive circle. Various counter-demands whipped into his ears over the link, and he shouted them down, gripping the gun yokes with both of his huge hands and sending tight bursts of hammer fire into the starboard hills. The convoy vehicles reluctantly obliged, following Bragg's orders, circling round and forming a defensive position that the remaining outriders circled. Vehicles 2 and 4 in the convoy took heavy hits, and vehicle 6 exploded outright as a rocket torched into its tractor unit. The side paneling of the cargo unit rippled off as internal explosions blistered out through the metal skin, shredding it. Scraps of metal hull span away from the boiling black-smoked fireball, puffing hundreds of individual ripples in the ashy sand all around. Relieved at the turret guns by Trooper Cavo, Bragg dropped down into the cab to find Milum and Tuvant sheltering under window level, the grid shields and hatches pulled up.
"This is madness, you stupid kek!" Tuvant bellowed. "They'll pin us down and murder us all!"
"I don't think these bandits are really so tough," Bragg began.
Tuvant turned on him.
"You kekhead! They're all over us! God Emperor, but there are thousands of bandits out here, more than enough to kill us all! We should have kept moving! Stopping like this will give them all a chance to congregate for the kill!"
Bragg shambled across to the Caligulan drivers. There was a dull look in his eye Tuvant didn't like. With one meaty, hairy-knuckled paw, Bragg lifted Tuvant off the cabin deck by his throat.
"I'm in charge here," he growled,
his voice as deep and solid as his build, reverberative.
"The Colonel Commissar said so. If we have to fight our way through to Calpurnia a micron at a time, we will. And we will all fight. Clear?"
Clear,
gasped Tuvant, going blue.
"Now, can you make yourself useful?"
"How?"
snarled Milum acidly from behind. Bragg dropped Tuvant, who sprawled, retching, and turned to face the other driver. Milum had his greasy axle bar in his hands.
"You don't scare me, Ghost."
"Then you must be very stupid,"
Bragg muttered, turning aside without interest. Milum launched forward to crush the big man's skull with 5 kilos of cold-stamped metal. Bragg broke stride lightly, impossibly lightly, it seemed, for such a great bulk. He caught the descending bar in one palm. There was an audible slap. Milum gasped as the bar was pulled out of his hands. Bragg tossed it aside.
"You can start by not attacking me. You fething non-combatants really wind me up. Where the faith would you be if we hadn't come to pull your asses out of the chaos pit? Safe and sound in Aurelian Hive, probably,"
Milum jeered.
"Not out in the Deadlands, surrounded by terrorist infantry."
Bragg shrugged.
"Probably. With the other cowards. Are you a coward, Driver Milum?"
"Kick you."
"Just asking. The Colonel Commissar told me to watch out for cowards. Told me to shoot them on sight, as they were treasonous dogs who didn't deserve the salvation of the Golden Throne. I wouldn't shoot them. Not me."
There was a pause. Bragg smiled.
"I'd just hit them. Has a similar result. Do you want me to hit you, Milum?" No. Then don't assault me again. You can help, even if you don't know the business end of a weapon from your own arse. Get on the Voxcaster. Recite the Ecclesiarchy's Oath of Obedience. You know that?"
"Of course I know that."
"Then what?" "Then recite it again. Make it clear. I'm proud. Recite it again. Then again. And then again. If you get bored, insert the Emperor's Daily Prayer, for variation. Maybe the Imperial Litany of Deliverance for good measure. Fill the Vox channels with soothing, inspiring words. Can you do that?"
Milum nodded and crossed to the Voxcaster built into the tractor's dash.
"Good man,"
Bragg said. Milum started to speak into the caster horn, remembering the verses he had learned as a child. Outside, laser and stub fire whined into the circled convoy. The outriders were laying in hard. Merrin drew his bike in so that Cafran could do real damage to the slowly encircling bandits. Falk, McTee, and Tanak ran the line. From the back of Falk's machine, Logris excelled and scored 4 kills. McTee's gunner, Layman, made one of his own before the upper part of his head was scythed off by a las shot at the mouth. Tanak and Grummid made 6, maybe 7, good kills before a short-range missile ended their lives and their glory,
Debris and body parts flew out from a searing typhoon of ignited bike fuel.
"Bragg! Bragg! We have to retreat!"
Weln yelled from the half-track, Abbat dead behind him, and Brostin blazing with his flamer. In the cab of his freighter, Bragg was calmly unwrapping his autocannons from a felt shroud. Behind him, Milum was steadily reciting into the vox horn. Bragg paused, fingering his microbead to open the vox line.
"No, Weln. No retreat. No retreat," he said simply.
Rubbing his sore throat, Tuvant scrambled up from the floor, about to argue with the huge ghost, but he stopped dead as he saw the weapon that the Tanith hulk was preparing. Not one, but two autocannons, the like of which were usually fixed to tripod or pintle mounts. Bragg had them lashed together with a makeshift trigger array made out of a bent ration pack fork so he could fire them as a pair. Long belt loops of ammunition played out from the gun slots, leading back to a parcel of round boxes. Bragg punched out the Perspex window section from the rear of the cab and laid his twin muzzles across the sill. He looked back at Tuvant.
"You wanted something?"
"No,"
Tuvant replied, ducking suddenly as stubfire perforated the cab and showered them with metal shards and soot.
"I can fire this on my own if I have to, but it would be easier if I had someone to feed."
Tuvant blinked. Then he scrambled forward and grabbed the ammo belts, easing them around so they would pull unobstructed from the boxes.
"Thanks,"
smiled Bragg quickly, then turned to hunch and squint out of the window port. He squeezed the trigger assembly. The twin guns barked deafeningly in the confines of the cab. Milum paused in his recitation and covered his ears with a grimace. Tuvant shuddered, but kept working dutifully to play the ammo belts out clear and clean. Shell cases billowed through the air like chaff. Bragg's first devastating salvo had gone wide, passing over the top of the nearby cliffs. He grinned at himself and adjusted his aim.
"Try again,"
he murmured.
"What?"
asked Tuvant.
"Nothing."
Bragg opened fire again, the barking chatter of the paired guns filling the cab again. Now his shots were stitching along the valley wall and crossing the far dunes. Something he touched exploded in a violent plume of red fire. Bragg played his guns around that area again for a minute or so. Out on the dunes, with the convoy circled behind him, Mert crawled forward, readjusting his aim. He could hear the anxious but determined voice reciting the Emperor's prayer over his earplug, and it filled him with a sense of right and dignity. He blinked dust out of his eyes. He ditched his sand goggles the moment he'd hit the ground. Larkin had told him that nothing should get between a sniper's scope and his naked eye. "You only saw the truth of the world when your eye was clear and you were looking down your scope," Larkin had said in training. Mert smiled at the memory. He remembered how Larkin would often carry his scope around in his thigh pouch and take it out to look at people through it.
"To tell if they're lying," he always said.
Mert's scope wasn't lying now. He could see over 3 dozen bandits advancing over the dunes under cover of the foggy dust kicked up by the firefight. They were running low, heads down, hugging the contours of the ground. Mert took aim at the nearest one. He sighed and fired, timing his finger to the moment of respiratory emptiness so nothing in his torso would jerk the aim. The laser burst punched through the top of the bandit's bowl helmet, presented as it was by his head-down approach. The shot probably passed down through his skull, his neck, and his torso, following the line of his spinal column, Mert thought, as the figure dropped stone dead in a crumpled pile. He adjusted his aim and took another bandit in the face when he looked up to take a bearing. A slight swing to the left, and another came into his sight, scurrying forward to gain new cover. A sigh, a squeeze, a slight recoil. The figure flipped back and fell silent. Mert readjusted and was about to target a small group of infantry when their position dissolved in a haze of heat and outflung debris. Missile hit, he thought. Rahan and Nain were keeping the aim of the missile turret low, sliding off single shots that hugged the ground cover and buried themselves in the foe. McTeague edged the half-track along the lip of the folded dunes, skirting the enemy as best he could. His weapon crew had almost expended their missiles, so he set the drive in idle and clambered back into the turret bed to set up the stub gun folded away in a deck locker. He had it up and lashed into the armored side panel of the track as Rahan volleyed off 5 missiles high into the air. They looked like burning javelins as they arched over the desert and flew down onto unseen targets below the dune.
McTee fired the autocannon mount Lehman had been manning until the feeder belt jammed and the gun glowed red. With a curse, he snatched up his las rifle and dived over the side. Enemy lasfire reached his vehicle a moment later and blew it up in a shower of metal debris that pattered around him as he crawled through the sand. McTee felt a sharp and painful impact in his ankle. Looking back, prone on his belly, he realized his combat trousers were smoldering from the wash of cinders, and a thick piece of metal debris had pierced his foot. He beat down the fire, then rolled over to yank the debris from his ankle. It was the shattered handle of his vehicle's autogun return, he realized. The pain was immense. He pulled at it and passed out momentarily. Coming to, he realized that the shrapnel wasn't going to come free from the bones of his foot without a surgeon. He chewed down a handful of painkillers, and as the heady high smacked into his brain, he rolled over and began firing his las gun into the dune crest behind him. Whelm blasted away from his vehicle's turret next to Brostin, who had ditched his flamer for a las rifle. Bandits were running at them from a scoop of low-lying desert, and they shot everything that moved. McKendrick realized his guns were out as the last of the belt feed wickered through the slot, and the weapons coughed dry. Bandit troops were all over him, charging up to take his machine. He pulled out his las pistol and shot the first one through the head, gutting the second and blowing a knee off the third. Then he took a glancing wound in the left shoulder that turned him sideways and knocked him to the deck. There was a roaring sound. Merrin's bike came over the rise in a puff of dust, landing hard, Kafran hammering the enemy with his guns. Merrin slewed to the left as Kafran played the cannons around, exploding